Welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope with Emily Sutherland. Fables, Queer and Familiar, a book by Meg Merrilies, published by Wakefield Press and about to hit a bookshop near your home. Meg is an established author whose prize-winning novel The First Week was very favourably reviewed. Now, that novel told a rather tragic story. I believe the new book is a different kettle of fish. Meg is in the studio, so I can ask her to tell us about Fables, Queer and Familiar, and perhaps, Meg, you could begin by explaining the title.
Yes. Well, it came out of a serial called Adelaide Days. When we were publishing it, we were thinking, OK, it's a collection of Adelaide Days, and we're looking for a more generic sort of title. And we liked Fables, Queer and Familiar because it's sort of multi-layered, you know, it's fables as in now everybody's sitting comfortably, I'm going to tell you a story.
Yeah.
And queer as in it's basically about some lesbian grannies and their world, their families and so on. And familiar has that double layer of meaning that it's nice and homely and it's benign and but it's also a bit, you know, familiars are the black cats and so on, companions to witches, so we like that little touch too.
Well, are you suggesting there's a coven of lesbian grannies in, somewhere in Adelaide?
I'd like to think so.
Where did the idea come from?
After I'd finished my first novel and it had come out, I was thinking about the novel that's been in the back of my mind for a long time, which is the sort of, now I'm going to tell the definitive lesbian story of the last 30 years, or mainly of 30 years ago, really. And I finished a draft of it and I wanted to put it away to compost the way you do. And I started writing a little blog, really, with using some of the minor characters from the novel. And they gradually took on a life of their own over the next 18 months.
As characters do, don't they?
So I'm not sure what's going to happen to the composting novel in the meantime.
Was that a more serious one, was it?
A slightly more serious. Well, not terribly serious. Mixed. Hopefully moving, but also funny in parts, yeah. Whereas the serial has been pretty much not serious. Occasionally it touches on serious issues, but
I think, as I remembered, it was hunting for a dog that got lost somewhere.
That's right. No, they're trying to find a dog for one of the grandchildren, yes.
And someone got lost in the second-hand
shop? Oh, the tip shop, yes, yeah. Yes. One of the grandchildren, well, both of the grandchildren get lost in the tip shop. Yes, that's a terrifying episode.
Yes, yes. I could hardly leave my computer. But look, why don't I get you to read some and give people an idea?
Sure. This is called On the Rocks. Anne and Julia escape to what they regard as their own personal rock pool. They strip and lower themselves in. After a few minutes of thrashing, they're warm enough to loll, the water lapping around them. There are things to discuss, issues to straighten out. For a start, the advertiser has just announced which York Peninsula beach communities will be inundated by rising sea levels. Anne is alarmed. She's not taken climate change personally until now. Julia, who owns and runs a green engineering company and works every day on the nitty-gritty challenges, is impatient. Well, what did you think? It would only happen in Bangladesh and Antarctica? Things are a little strained. The thought of Martina still hangs between them. Anne sniffs. I just hadn't thought about it so specifically. I thought we'd be high enough here. We're more than a metre above sea level, aren't we? The whole sea level thing is so misleading. Averages. I wish they wouldn't talk like that, as though the sea was flat. It's the storms that'll take us out. One big storm would do it, combined with a high tide. Oh, great. Thanks for clarifying that. Across the rocks, out of sight of the grannies, a teenage boy approaches. Nathan has also escaped, leaving his family behind. He wants to be alone. He kicks moodily at rocks and climbs up to a vantage point above the sea. The sight of two people in the water below startles him, especially when Anne rolls over and he realizes they have nothing on. He crawls backwards, sweating. He knows who they are. He's been coming to the third shack along from theirs since he was a baby. One of them is Sarah's gran, though he doesn't understand how that can be possible. Everyone knows they're lessees. Did they see him? There was something in the water bobbing about below their chins, sort of inflated sea slug things. He replays the image in his mind, but there's no doubt they were breasts, at least two breasts. He stumbles across the rocks to his bike, pursued by the image. Breasts, breasts. He pedals furiously homewards, discomfort gradually replaced by a mixture of exultation and fierce heroism. Poor Sarah. He must tell no one, no one at all. The secret is safe with him. The grannies are unaware that they've been observed. They lapse into a discussion of Tara, brought on by her Christmas gift to Julia of an expensive pocket knife. Did she pay actual cash for it, or has she returned to her magpie ways? Julia remembers her own youthful exploits, but knows better than to mention them. This is the latest of many discussions about Tara, years of discussions. Tara is Anne's fallback topic. When nothing else is going on, her mind turns automatically to her youngest child, and she starts to worry away at the intractable problem of what to do about Tara. As far as Julia can see, there's nothing to be done about Tara. She is an independent adult. But Julia makes allowances for a mother's feelings. Her role is to listen and grunt soothingly. She lies back in the water and closes her eyes.
Thank you, Meg. I was just thinking that so-called queer literature has been around for a long time, but tends to be more, shall we say, serious,
yes,
taking the whole subject more seriously, and I think you've come to it with a more, this is just life.
Yes, I really, I agree with you. I think some of it, you know, as with any oppressed group, I suppose, it tends to have an edge to it. I just wanted to write about some really ordinary women who probably live around the corner from you, and, you know, if they're not your sister or your mother or somebody. Also, I wanted to write something that's benign and fun and light and positive.
Not in your face sort of thing.
Nobody kills themselves or does anything disastrous.
And there's nothing more salacious than floating in a
No, the odd breast appears, but
nothing, not shades of grey. Let's listen to some music then, because you've brought in something that rather fits in with that, Coming Out Blues, sung by Vicky Bennett. And it's more or less a message to mothers of lesbian daughters not to panic.
It is. I think we should dedicate this to all the mothers out there who've had to deal with lesbian daughters.
Fine.
Agatha's got to tell Mama there'll be no husband. Got to tell Mama there'll be no husband. Well, I'll be weeping and wailing, tearing hell. They'll be throwing that glory box into the air. When I tell my mama there will be no husband, I got those gotta tell mama there'll be no children. Gotta tell mama there'll be no children. There'll be wringing of hands and gnashing of teeth. There'll be mumbling and moaning in disbelief. When I tell my mama there'll be no grandchildren. Tell mama, my partner's come to stay. while all the startled expressions and shaking of heads over two grown women with only one bed. When I tell my mama my body's come to stay, gotta tell mama,
gotta tell mama,
gotta tell mama,
gotta tell mama,
gotta tell mama, there'll be no husband, gotta tell mama, there'll be no children, gotta tell mama, that woman's here to stay.
And that was Vicky Bennett with the Coming Out Blues, and I'm talking to Meg Merrilees about her book, Fables, Queer and Familiar. Now, you said your characters, Meg, are not, they're ordinary people. Could be the woman living around the corner,
yes,
or next door. Well, tell us about them.
Well, one of them, one of the two grannies are the central characters. One of them has three adult children of her own, and two of those children have children of theirs, mm-hmm. so there are small and younger grandchildren around. Then they have various friends of their own age, contemporaries, so they're part of a community. I think that's the other thing, as you were saying before, some of the gay literature that's been around has, to my mind, it doesn't always give that sense of community, which is one of the most, certainly in the lesbian community, it's one of the most powerful things.
Well, perhaps they have to be because they do feel discriminated against.
Yeah.
Or have been.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, your relationships are strong. And for many people, they're in lieu of blood family relationships. Julia, the other granny, her mother is still around. She's about to turn 90. She's a very upright, feisty sort of 90-year-old. Then there are assorted neighbours and, you know, they really are the people that you might meet in any suburb in Adelaide, and they do the things that we do in Adelaide. They go to the market, they regularly meet in the food hall, the cousins meet, the siblings and their kids meet to have Friday night at the food hall, and they catch the tram and they ride bikes and they try and dodge the tour down under cyclists and
they go bushwalking and get lost.
Bushwalking and get lost. Yes, exactly.
So really, it should be thought of more as a book about people in a community just living lives and doing things that we can relate to.
Very much, and it's very much an Adelaide story. We may have made the title generic, but it's still very Adelaide.
Now tell me, you've got illustrations for this book. Who did that?
Yes, a wonderful friend of mine, an artist from Sydney called Chia Moan, has done really... Chia is a subversive force of nature, and she's just taken the text and run with it, and quirky little cartoon illustrations, really. It's been really interesting collaborating. I've never tried to do that before. It's been very interesting. She, you know, she's had her own ideas, and I've said, oh, you know, you do whatever you think. I don't really have a very clear idea of what they look like. And then the very first illustration she showed me had one of the little boys, and he had freckles, and I said, oh, no, he hasn't got freckles. So I've had to be careful to, A, realise that I do actually have an image of what they're like.
You do. When you're writing, do you see it happening, like a film almost?
It's funny, isn't it? I haven't thought of myself as a very visual person. You know, I'm not consciously thinking of what they look like, but obviously in the back of my mind I do have quite a clear idea.
Some writers have the opposite problem. They're so they know exactly what their characters look like, so they don't see any need to describe them in the book.
Yes.
Because everybody should know.
I think that would be a difficult writer for an illustrator to work with. At least I'm fairly fuzzy about it and really happy for Chia to go with it. Chia, so some of the little running gags through the illustrations in the book have got very little to do with the text. We've ended up with a rat eating a book on the back cover. which is one of Cheer's little running gags from the... There's only one mention of a rat in the book, you'll be relieved to hear. But
well, I thought it's the black cat that would be safe.
It's a black cat, of course, yes.
So that was an interesting and perhaps a new experience for you as a writer.
The collaboration?
To work with an illustrator.
Very much so, yes, and it's been lovely.
Yes. Now, the other thing you've mentioned is you've actually recorded it and it's going to be broadcast.
Yes, I have. I've recorded the whole thing. We've used Jen Clark's lovely music. She's playing on dulcimer and various other things. A traditional air called Merrily Kiss the Quaker's Wife, which may be familiar to people. But I have to put in a little plug for Jen. You can find out more about her at www.jenclark.net. She's a wonderful... She does all sorts of things, but she's a wonderful musician. Used to live in Adelaide. She's back in the UK now. And, yes, particularly playing dulcimer and that sort of group of instruments, some lovely music.
Oh, well, let's listen. Jenny Clark, and she played Merrily Kiss the Quaker's Wife. Now, that music, the first part of that music, was part of the theme that goes with the reading of Mag's book, but we haven't got, I mean, we've had the theme now, so perhaps you could read us a little bit more from your book, Mag.
Art, High and Low. Anne meets her friend Maddie at Bliss Cafe for date shakes, green soup, and a dissection of Writer's Week. They throw highlights at each other. Great war poets, the Tasmanian frontier, 19th century English debs seeking husbands in India. Biography of Orpheus. Oh, I missed that. But was Orpheus a real person? Well, so Anne Rowe says, and she's a fellow of, I don't know, something or other. Lovely, hugely erudite, but unassuming and so enthusiastic. One of those mad English rosebuds. What about that Dutchman, if it's enthusiasm you're after? Oh, yes, Frank Westerman, biography of Lipizzana horses. He was bouncing out of his chair. I'm pretty sure he had breakfast on his T-shirt, too. Perversely, this raises Frank Westerman enormously in their estimation. Anne has bought two of his books. Okay, hats. What did you think? For many years, Anne and Maddie have been studying the hats at Writers Week, the Flemington of the literary world. Disappointing, I thought. Nothing outstanding. Over the weekend, it just wasn't hot enough. Lots of people weren't bothering. It was hot enough during the week, stinking. But humid. You don't want a hat when it's muggy. You want a spray bottle and a fan. I suppose. A hat gets in the way of the sweat evaporating. We should plot the incidence of hats against the weather each year. Temperature, humidity, wind factor. There may be a global warming trend. Anne scoops out the last drop of soup with her finger and thinks about a spreadsheet. But Maddie is not yet ready for science. I did see one gorgeous hat with flowers embroidered all over the crown. I thought I might copy it. Remember the year someone wore pink feathers held in place by chopsticks? Linda Javen, wasn't it? And that wasn't feathers, dear. That was her hair. Well, it was a highlight, anyhow. That reminds me, there was a young woman with her skirt inside out. What, fashion statement? I don't think so, not that sort of get-up. It was subtle, but I could tell from the seams and hem. The weird thing was that about an hour later I sat behind a woman with her T-shirt inside out. I could see the label. Oh, it's a new study. We'll watch whether it varies with the weather. Do you think we're frivolous? Well, I hope so. Somebody has to be. They turn their attention to the literary luminary who provided the closing address, a wide-ranging multidisciplinary survey of Europeans in Australia. Am I right in thinking that he spoke for an hour and a quarter without once naming a woman? Yeah, he really distinguished himself, but he did mention a feminist anthropologist going up to Cape York at some stage. Who would that have been? I don't know. Her name is lost to us. Oh, surprise, surprise. It's because we're frivolous. High culture is closed to women. We're too interested in egg stains to be commemorated. He did express himself beautifully, though. Misogyny? Beautiful? They go off to the International Women's Day march against misogyny to express their ire, and from there to WOMAD to express their animal spirits.
I was thinking as you read that about our cabinet in the government.
I know, it's shocking,
isn't it? Full of women, full of women.
Yeah, well, this was written at the time of the Gillard government, you know, when people were, you know, the sexism directed against Julia Gillard was shocking, really, wasn't it?
I think it was. If nothing else, it was really disrespectful.
Yes, totally. You didn't have to be a Labour voter. You didn't have to support what she was doing in any way, but it was vitriolic. It was horrible.
And she smiled through it all.
Yes, she did. She was remarkably stoic.
Yes. But getting back to your book, you have drawn on things that happen, as you say, in Adelaide, the Writers'
and
Week and the
market
and all those lovely things.
Yeah.
And is the book actually out yet, or is it just
about
to be launched?
No, a couple of weeks' wait. It should be out by mid to late November.
Who's launching it? Have you picked that?
Margie Fisher is going to launch it on the 25th of November at the Writers' Centre. Margie is on the board of the Feast Festival and has been an absolute stalwart of all sorts of lesbian and gay politics in Adelaide for many, many years. So I'm thrilled that she's got time to launch it. It'll be a feast event. That'll be the time of the Feast Festival.
But I think we should stress it's not a lesbian book because I've read some of it on your blog. So I was familiar with the idea, which is why I wanted to invite you in. And, I mean, it's no secret that I'm not a lesbian, but it was just great fun reading it. Yes.
I think one of the things that was lovely about the blog was the people who contacted me from all over the place and the most unexpected people. There's one episode called What Lesbians Do in Bed, which, as you can imagine, mostly what lesbians do in bed is like any other couple in bed worry about who's hot and who's cold and whether they can arrive at a mutual temperature. Mm. And I had a lovely message from somebody from a man saying, oh, that's exactly what it's like for me and my wife. And that's been the really nice thing about it, that it's ordinary.
And you haven't had anything negative?
No, not at all. No, no.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Meg, for coming in and sharing both the music that fits in with the book and the readings from the book, and I really hope it goes very, very well.